demands on our team clear. Question 2. Psychological safety. Can we take risks on this team without feeling insecure or embarrassed? Question 3. What's the meaning of our work? Are we working on something that's personally important for each of us? Number 4. Dependability. Can we count on each other to do high-quality work on time? And 5. Do we fundamentally believe that the work we're doing matters? What is the impact of our work? The first item in this list, structure and clarity, is the raison d'être for objectives and key results. The others are all key facets of a healthy workplace culture, and they tie directly to the OKR superpowers and the CFR communication tools. Consider peer-to-peer dependability. In a high-functioning OKR environment, transparency and alignment make people more diligent in meeting their obligations. At Google, teams assume collective responsibility for goal achievement or for failures. At the same time, individuals are held responsible for specific key results. Peak performance is the product of collaboration and accountability. An OKR culture is an accountable culture. You don't push towards a goal just because the boss gave you an order. You do it because every OKR is transparently important to the company and to the colleagues who are counting on you. No one wants to be seen as the one holding back the team. Everybody takes pride in moving progress forward. It's a social contract, but a self-governed one. In the Progress Principle, Teresa Amabile and Stephen Kramer analyzed 26 project teams, 238 individuals, and 12,000 employee diary entries. They concluded that high motivation cultures rely on a mix of two elements: catalysts, which they define as actions that support work, and sound to me much like OKRs. These include setting clear goals, allowing autonomy, providing sufficient resources and time, helping with the work, openly learning from problems and successes, and allowing a free exchange of ideas. Those actions are catalysts. The other element is nourishers. Those are acts of interpersonal support that bear a striking resemblance to CFRs: respect, recognition, encouragement, emotional comfort, and opportunities for affiliation. In the high-stakes arena of culture change, OKRs lend us purpose and clarity as we plunge into the new. CFRs supply the energy we need for the journey, where people have authentic conversations and get constructive feedback and recognition for superior accomplishment. Enthusiasm becomes infectious. The same goes for stretch thinking and a commitment to daily improvement. The companies that treat their people as valued partners are the ones with the best customer service. They have the best products and the strongest sales growth. They're the ones who are going to win. As continuous performance management rises to the fore, once-a-year employee surveys are giving way to real-time feedback. One frontier is pulsing, an online snapshot of your workplace culture. These signal-capturing questionnaires may be scheduled weekly or monthly by HR, or made part of an ongoing drip campaign. Either way, pulses are simple, quick, and wide-ranging. For example, are you getting enough sleep? Have you met recently with your manager to discuss goals and expectations? Do you have a clear sense of your career path? Are you getting enough challenge and motivation and energy? Are you feeling in the zone? Feedback is a listening system. In the new world of work, leaders cannot wait for negative critiques on Glassdoor or for valued contributors to exit for another job. They need to listen and capture signals as they are emitted. What if a goal-setting platform could pulse 2 or 3 questions to employees whenever they log in? What if it merged quantitative data on goal progress with qualitative input from frequent conversations and pulsing feedback? We're not far away from software that will prompt a manager, "Talk to Bob. Something's going on with his team." As OKRs build goal muscle, CFRs make those sinews flexible and responsive. Pulsing gauges the organization's real-time health, its body and soul, and its work and culture. Coursera, the world's leader in online higher education, jumped into OKRs in 2013, just a year after its founding, with timely input from its then-president Laila Ibrahim, an Intel alumna who revered Andy Grove. The organization tried something rare and exemplary. They connected OKRs to their company's values and lofty mission statement, a clear expression of its culture. Quote, "We envision a world where anyone, anywhere, can transform their lives by accessing the world's best learning experience." And Coursera rolled up its team-level objectives to top-line strategic objectives, which in turn rolled up to five core values. First, students come first. So we'll engage and increase value to students and extend the reach to new students. Second value, great partners. Be a great partner to universities. Third value, think big and advance pedagogy. Develop an innovative world-class education platform. Fourth value, care for teammates and be human, be humble. Build a strong, healthy organization. Fifth value, do good, do well. Experiment and develop a sustainable business model. Each of these core values was mapped to a corresponding set of OKRs. And as an example, I'm going to read to you an OKR for students first. The objective is to extend Coursera's reach to new students, as measured by four key results. The first is that Coursera would perform A/B tests, learn and iterate on ways to acquire new students and engage existing students. The second is Coursera would increase mobile monthly active users. The third is Coursera would create internal tools to track key growth metrics. And the fourth, launch features to enable instructors to create more engaging videos. OKRs furnished the pathway for Coursera's mission. They enabled teams to articulate their goals and to align with the company's objectives and with its broader values as well. Years later, the company's friendly, inclusive culture remains a welcome contrast to the blustery, combative personality of many Silicon Valley startups. As Rick Levin, Coursera's former CEO, says, "I can't imagine where we'd be without OKRs. The discipline forces us to look back every quarter and to hold ourselves accountable, and to look ahead every quarter to imagine how we can better live our values." In 2007, the preeminent business philosopher and friend Dov Seidman published a groundbreaking book on culture entitled How. Why How We Do Anything Means Everything. Dov started from the premise that culture guides people's behaviors, or how things really happen in an organization. In our open-sourced, hyper-connected world, behavior defines a company more meaningfully than product lines or market share. As Dov said to me recently, it's the one thing that can't be copied or commoditized. Dov's big idea is that companies that outbehave their competition will also outperform them. He identified a value-driven model, the self-governing organization, as a place where long-term legacy trumps the next quarter's return on investment. These organizations don't merely engage their workers, they inspire them. They replace rules with shared principles. Carrots and sticks are supplanted by a common sense of purpose. They are built around trust, which enables risk-taking, which spurs innovation, which drives performance and productivity. In the past, Dove tells me, when employees just needed to do the next thing right, to follow orders to the letter, culture didn't matter so much. But now we live in a world where we're asking people to do the next right thing. A rule book can tell me what I can or can't do. I need culture to tell me what I should do. That is a majestic, potentially transformative idea. But as Dove has acknowledged, it's one thing to proclaim values like courage or compassion or creativity. It's another to scale them. Scaling requires a system with metrics. Dove says, What we choose to measure is a window into our values, into what we value. Because if you measure something, you're telling people that it matters. To validate his argument and test his observations, Dove needed data. Lots of it. His team at LRN embarked on a rigorous empirical analysis that has been refined over the years and published in a series of annual How reports, where Andy Grove added qualitative goals to balance quantitative ones. Dove has found a way to quantify seemingly abstract values like trust. His trust index measures specific behaviors, the direct hows of transparency, for example. I avoid asking people about their perceptions, Dove tells me. I don't ask, do you feel your company is honest with you? I look at the information flows. Does the company hoard information? Does it meet it out on a need-to-know basis, or is it flowing freely? If you go around your boss and talk to somebody more senior, are you punished or celebrated? As of 2016, the How report covered 17 countries and more than 16,000 employees. It found that self-governing organizations had grown to 8% of the pie, up from 3% in 2012. Of those value-driven companies, 96% scored high in systematic innovation. 95% had superior employee engagement and loyalty. Out-behavior did indeed equate to out-performance. 94% reported increased market share. When Dove told me that there was no more powerful cultural force than active transparency, where human beings are opening up, sharing the truth, bringing others in, being vulnerable, I could see Andy Grove smiling. An OKR-CFR culture is above all a transparent culture. It goes back to the lessons I first learned at Intel and have seen affirmed countless times at Google and dozens of other forward-looking companies. Vision-based leadership beats command and control. The flatter the organization chart, the more agile the organization. When performance management is a networked two-way street, individuals grow into greatness. In the end, it's all about knitting ourselves to one another. As Dove observes, collaboration itself, our ability to connect, is an engine of growth and innovation. Given the chance, OKRs and CFRs will build top-down alignment, team-first networking, and bottom-up autonomy and engagement, the pillars of any vibrant, value-driven culture. But in some scenarios, as you're about to hear in the following tale about Lumeris, culture change may need to be initiated before OKRs are deployed. In others, as Bono and his One campaign will show, a charismatic CEO founder, in this case literally a rock star, can call on OKRs to transform culture from the top. And so our final two stories explore this rich interrelationship between culture change and structured goal setting. Chapter 19, Culture Change, the Lumeris Story. With Andrew Cole, the Lumeris Chief HR and Organizational Development Officer. When an organization isn't yet ready for total openness and accountability, there's culture work that may be needed before OKRs are implemented. As Jim Collins observes in Good to Great, first, you need to get the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, and the right people in the right seats. Only then do you turn the wheel and step on the gas. Not too long ago, a leader in value-based healthcare stood at a crossroads. Lumeris is a St. Louis technology and solutions firm that provides software, services, and know-how to healthcare providers and payers. Its clientele ranges from university hospital networks to traditional insurers. The company had started in 2006 by partnering with a group of 200 St. Louis area physicians through their federally regulated insurance company, Essence Healthcare, to serve 65,000 Missouri seniors with a Medicare Advantage plan. Tapping into a vast trove of patient data, Lumeris helps partner organizations convert traditional fee-for-service, volume-based sick care into something else entirely, healthcare delivery system that incentivizes prevention and discourages needless tests or detrimental hospital stays. Under this value-based model, primary care doctors take responsibility for their patients cradle to grave. The goal is to improve the quality of life while conserving precious resources and dollars. At Lemaris, they've shown how those objectives can work hand in hand. According to CEO Mike Long, the moonshot goal is to rationalize the nation's healthcare supply chain. Quote, in every other industry, success is based on transparent cost-quality service and the availability of choices. None of those principles work in healthcare because the system is completely opaque. Doctors have difficulty knowing what services are requisitioned on your behalf, much less what they cost. So how then can you hold them accountable for financial outcomes? It's a transformational challenge, and Lumeris, aided by OKRs, is leading the charge. Given its reliance on transparent data, Lumeris seemed a natural fit for Andy Grove's goal-setting system. But as Andrew Cole, the former head of HR, will tell you, adaptation was anything but simple. If cultural barriers go unaddressed, as Andrew says, quote, the antibodies will be set loose, and the body will reject the donor organ of OKRs. An experienced architect of sweeping organizational change, Andrew was the right person in the right seat to make sure the OKR transplant took.
When I came to Lemaris, they had been working with OKRs for three-quarter cycles on paper. They had an outstanding employee participation rate, or so I was told. But after a deep-dive analysis, I realized the process was superficial. At the end of each quarter, a lone HR person ran around like a Jack Russell, nipping at managers' heels to get updated numbers before the board meeting. People dropped into the software platform, conveniently adjusted an objectives metrics, and said, oh yeah, I got that done. They'd slap on a date and check off a box. It looked great on PowerPoint, but it wasn't real. Few of our people understood the business rationale behind OKRs. We were missing explicit buy-in from executive leadership. Most of all, nobody held anybody accountable for getting the system right. When I examined people's objectives, they weren't connected to the actual work. I'd go to managers and ask, why does this show up in your OKRs? In many cases, they had no idea how their objectives linked to what we were working to achieve. It was so much window dressing. I tried to understand an organization before I charge in, breaking things. But two quarters later, I still wasn't sure the OKR process could be saved. In a closed board session, I asked John Doerr, if I don't think this tool is right for us, then we won't do it, right? And he said, absolutely. By then, I diagnosed our root problem, a passive-aggressive approach. No one had addressed the basic question everyone at Lumeris was asking. What's in it for me? Though the OKR program was sincerely intended to improve goal setting and collaborative communication, people didn't trust it. Unless we changed the environment, it couldn't possibly succeed. Transformation doesn't happen overnight. The executive team had brought in OKRs to help integrate two clashing internal cultures. Essence, the health insurance company formed by the St. Louis Doctors Group, was risk-averse, per Hippocrates. Lumeris pushed to the edge to find the next big tech and data insights. Essence nurtured a proprietary model within a hyper-competitive industry. Lumeris took those learnings and shared them with the world. As demand for our services began surging, this cultural gap was slowing us down. In May 2015, 11 weeks after I arrived, we announced a total reorganization under the Lumeris umbrella, One company, our reasoning went, should have one name. I knew that OKRs could eventually be our lingua franca, a way to connect everyone's goals, but that would need to wait. Without cultural alignment, the world's best operational strategy will fail. HR transformation. People watch what you do more than what you say. Lumeris had a senior leadership with an old-school autocratic approach. They weren't living our core values: ownership, accountability, passion for the job, loyalty to the team. Nothing else would matter until those leaders exited the organization. We made sure they left us with their dignity and respect intact, a telling moment in any transformation project. At each and every cultural meeting, we told our employees, "You have the right, no, the obligation, to hold your executive team accountable for what we are saying our culture should be. If we're not following through, make an appointment or send an email or just walk up to us in the hallway and tell us we're not getting it done." It took 3 months for anyone to take us up on our invitation. Our CEO, Mike Long, engaged with a lunch group and said, "Why would anyone want to work in an environment with a fear of holding each other accountable?" That was a powerful inflection point, and people began to believe. But cultural change can be very personal. It took one conversation at a time to convince our employees that collaboration, shared accountability, and transparency would be rewarded, and to show they had nothing to fear from the new Lumeris. HR can be a potent vehicle for operating excellence. It's also the place where cultural change is crystallized. At the end of the day, culture is about people you recruit and the values they bring to bear. While Lumeris had a share of A and B players in middle management, there were also C players and below who'd been hired with erroneous criteria and vague interviews. There is no tool, OKRs included, that will work with the wrong instruction manual. Time is the enemy of transformation. We took less than 18 months to replace 85% of our HR professionals. Once senior management and frontline employees were fully on board, we tackled the tougher nut, strengthening middle management. That's typically a 3-year process, from start to steady state. When it's complete, your new culture is assured. So the objective was to institute a culture that attracted and retained A players. The key results we were seeking was, one, to focus on hiring A player manager leaders, two, optimize recruitment function to attract A player talent, three, to scrub all of our job descriptions, four, retrain everyone engaged in the interviewing process, 5, ensure ongoing mentoring coaching opportunities, and 6, create a culture of learning for development of new and existing employees. OKR resurrection. Late in 2015, I asked my HR team to dissect the company's earlier stab at OKRs. If we were to make another go of it, we needed to retrain everybody in the company, and I meant everybody. We wouldn't get a third chance. The following April, we relaunched the platform with a 60-day pilot program for 100 employees in our operations group. Our senior vice president of operations and delivery had his doubts going in, but with sharpened training plus improvements to the software, he became an enthusiast. Within less than 2 weeks, he was shooting emails to the pilot group. "Why did you write this objective that way? What's the metric here? I don't get this OKR. It isn't what I'm seeing from client feedback." And his people were thinking, "He's paying attention." I better look at this more closely. Winning our troops over to OKRs wasn't easy or instantaneous. Far from it. Transparency is scary. Admitting your failures, visibly, publicly, can be terrifying. We had to rewire people from how they had been raised since kindergarten. It's like your first scuba dive. When you go 35 feet down and the adrenaline is pumping and you're scared out of your wits, but when you come back up, you're exhilarated. You have a new insight into how things work beneath the surface. It's no different plunging into OKRs. Once you start having honest, vulnerable, two-way conversations with your direct reports, you begin to see what makes them tick. You feel their yearning to connect to things bigger than themselves. You hear their need for recognition that what they're doing matters. Through the open window of objectives and key results, each of you get to know the other's weaknesses with no worry of getting caught out. For managers, one particular benefit of OKRs is to lead them to hires who can compensate for their own limitations. Our people stopped dancing around their setbacks. They began to realize there's no shame in trying your hardest and failing. Not when OKRs help you fail smart and fail fast. The tide turned. We began hearing comments like, "I was a complete naysayer, but now I see how this can work for me." 98% of the pilot group became active users of our OKR platform. 72% said at least one objective aligned to the company's goals. And 92% of the pilot group said they now understood what my manager expects of me. Transparency without judgment. By then I was working with Art Glasgow, who came on board in the spring of 2016 as our president and COO. The two of us agreed there was no point to OKRs unless we went all the way. Art volunteered to be the executive sponsor, our goal-setting shepherd. He stood up in front of an all-hands meeting and said, "OKRs are how we are going to run the company, and we're going to use them to measure your bosses." That was the carrot that balanced the stick. Art's role in the crusade cannot be overestimated. He set the tone for what he called brutal transparency without judgment, and he made my job less lonely. In Q3, as OKRs were rolled out to all 800 Lumeris employees, we created our own coaches training program. Over a period of 5 weeks, our reinvented HR department worked overtime to meet with every single manager, more than 250 of them, in classroom-sized groups. We held open houses for them to come and talk to us one-on-one, and we told them up front there were no dumb questions. Those sessions became a golden opportunity. They were instrumental in building engagement and motivating people to deliver against expectations. Goal setting is more art than science. We weren't just teaching people how to refine an objective or a measurable key result. We had a cultural agenda as well. Why is transparency important? Why would you want people across other departments to know your goals? And why does what we are doing matter? What is true accountability? What's the difference between accountability with respect for others' failings and accountability with vulnerability for our own? How can OKRs help managers get work done through others? That's a big factor for scalability in a growing company. How do we engage other teams to adapt our objective as a priority and help assure we reach it? When is it time to stretch a team's workload or to ease off on the throttle? When do you shift an objective to a different team member or rewrite a goal to make it clearer or remove it completely? In building contributors' confidence, timing is everything. There is no handbook to address these questions. The wisdom resides in leaders with personal connections to their teams, to managers who can show what success looks like and know when to declare victory. My advice? Not too soon. Our training investment paid dividends. In Q3 of 2016, our people's first crack at the system, 75% of them created at least one OKR. Our retention numbers began moving in the right direction. Lumeris has fewer involuntary exit these days. They're hiring the right people and keeping the ones who can thrive there. Selling your Reds. Shortly after arriving, Art held a full-day off-site business review for the Lumeris leadership team. Now it's on the company's monthly calendar. When our top-line OKRs are projected on a screen, it's clear to see which leaders are making their objectives. Art doesn't like yellows, so every OKR is either green, on track, or red, at risk. There's no bell curve ambiguity, no place for problems to hide. The reviews run for 3 hours, with a dozen senior executives taking their turn. Little time is spent on people's greens. Instead, they sell their reds. The team votes on the most important at-risk OKRs for the company as a whole, then brainstorm together as long as it takes to get the objectives back on track. In the spirit of cross-departmental solidarity, individuals volunteer to buy their colleagues' reds. As Art says, "We're all here to help. We're all in the same bathwater." As far as I know, selling your reds is a unique use of OKRs, and one well worth emulating. Today's transformed Lumeris values interdependence. It prizes intentional coordination. OKRs make us focus on working on business instead of just working in the business, says Jeff Smith, Senior Vice President for U.S. Markets. Our regional market heads are quarterbacking opportunities versus running them solo. We're moving from hero culture to team culture. Smith was happily surprised to find the operations and delivery team tying their objectives directly to Smith's sales goals. In the past, Smith said, you'd hear things like, "I'm in delivery, you're in sales, just do your damn job." Now it's more like calling in a wide receiver to run a play. I'm here, let me help you. That was a result of the OKR process I never expected. First, Lumeris needed to nurture the right culture for OKRs to take root. Then it needed OKRs to sustain and deepen the new culture, to help it win people's hearts and minds. That's a campaign that never ends.
By all the metrics, 2017 was a banner year for Lumeris, now the market leader for value-based care. Quote, "The market's starting to shift," Art Glasgow tells me. "For the first time, I feel like our sales plan could start to get realistic. I might actually have to put in some stretch goals." At this point, Lumeris has launched partnerships with payers, provider groups, and health systems in 18 states, accounting for more than 1 million lives. The potential is staggering. If adopted nationwide, the company's Missouri model could save up to $800 billion annually in wasteful medical expenditures. More important, it would enhance our nation's quality and length of life. At today's Lumeris, OKRs are part of the wallpaper. As Andrew Cole might say, once people experienced the new company under the surface, they couldn't resist the temptation to keep diving back into it. Chapter 20, Culture Change, Bono's One Campaign Story. Bono, the co-founder of One. So we've just heard how OKRs can lock in culture change post hoc. As this our final story tells, Structured goal setting can also springboard an enriching cultural reset. For nearly two decades, the world's biggest rock star has waged, quote, an experiment in anti-apathy on a global scale. Bono's first big, hairy, audacious goal came out of the Jubilee 2000 global initiative, which led to $100 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries. 2 years later, with a startup grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Bono co-founded DATA for Debt, AIDS, Trade, and Africa, a global advocacy organization for public policy change. It declared its mission to address poverty, disease, and development in Africa in alliance with government bodies and other multinational NGOs. Bill Gates would say it's the best $1 million he ever spent. In 2004, Bono launched the One Campaign to catalyze a nonpartisan, grassroots activist coalition. It was the outside-facing complement to DATA's inside game. From the time we first met, I was struck by Bono's passion for factivism, or fact-based activism. In one's hard-headed, analytical, results-oriented environment, OKRs were an easy sell. For the last 10 years, they've helped clarify the organization's priorities, a tall order when your mission is to change the world. According to David Lane, the organization's former CEO, we needed a process of discipline to keep us from trying to do everything. As one has grown, it leaned on OKRs to achieve fundamental culture change. It is pivoting from working on Africa to working in and with Africa. As David tells me, there's been a dramatic philosophical change in how people think about helping the developing world develop itself to empower these countries to grow on their own. OKRs played a key role in how we did that. To improve the lives of the world's most vulnerable, One has helped deliver nearly $50 billion in funding for historic health initiatives. In addition, it's lobbied successfully for transparency rules to fight corruption and to channel resources from African oil and gas revenues into the war against extreme poverty. In 2005, alongside a Bill and Melinda Gates, Bono was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
Well, we had big goals for you two from the start. Could say megalomania set in from a very early age. Edge was already an accomplished guitar player. Larry's a pretty good drummer. I was a poor singer, and I actually haven't really couldn't play the bass at all. But here's what we thought. We're not as good as those other groups, so we better be better. We weren't as polished or accomplished as the bands we'd go and see, but we had chemistry. Whatever the thing is that makes it magic. We thought we could blow up the world if we didn't blow ourselves up first. We felt we could go all the way. They had everything, but we had it. That's what we used to repeat to ourselves about other bands. How did we measure effectiveness? Well, from the outset, we asked questions about our place in the world, be on the pop charts or the clubs, like, can our music be useful? Can art inspire political change? In 1979, even at 18, one of our first jobs was an anti-apartheid show. Another was a pro-contraception show. In Ireland, that was a big deal. Later in our early 20s, we deliberately became a nuisance to what you might call Irish terror groups and all the people who felt ambivalent about them. We felt compelled to say that blowing up kids in supermarkets can never be right. We gauged our political impact by the torrent of bile that came back at us. And then, at some point, you want your songs to chart. We worked quite hard to break through to the mainstream, actually. We were a live phenomenon, but our singles didn't do very well. So we judged our success by selling tickets. And then by selling albums. Picking our fights. When we formed our non-profit DATA, D-A-T-A. We went about it exactly the same as I had with U2. It was a band. Lucy Matthew, Bobby Shriver, Jamie Drummond, and myself. We didn't know who was the singer, the bass player, the drummer, or the guitar player. But we knew we weren't a bunch of hippies and wishful thinkers. We knew we were much more punk rock. We had the sense that we were tough-minded opportunists. We were working on a single idea. Debt cancellation for the poorest countries. We were good at that, choosing one fight at a time and going at it with a vicious schedule. Then we went after universal access to anti-AIDS drugs, another clear goal, and I must say people did laugh in our face. You're out of your tiny mind. That's impossible. Why fight the most expensive disease when you can have a go at malaria or river blindness or finish off polio? And I remember saying, no, we're picking a fight with this disease because these two pills, it's one pill now, are a visual representation of inequality. If you live in Dublin or Palo Alto, you can get the pills and you live. If you live in Lilongwe, Malawi in Africa, you can't get the pills and you die. So because of an accident of longitude and latitude, you win or die? That didn't feel right. Anyway, I was sure we could win that argument because everyone knew such inequality was wrong. It was that simple. That was the years before we used OKRs, but even then I used to say, picture Everest, then describe how difficult the climb is, then describe how we're going to reach the summit. Like Everest, beating AIDS looks nearly impossible. First, you needed to be able to describe it. Then you could climb it. So now it's 2017. 21 million people are accessing the antiretroviral therapies. It's amazing. And AIDS-related deaths are down 45% in the last 10 years. New HIV infections in children are down by more than a half. And we're on pace to win the fight against mother-to-child transmission of that disease by 2020. I believe we will live to see an AIDS-free world in our lifetime. Growing up with OKRs, our NGO band was entrepreneurial in spirit, and we tracked our goals internally, but you can only go so far without process. Once we started to have real impact and real access, DATA, data, merited more data, more measurable procedures, more measurable outcomes. Then we brought 11 different groups together to form a coalition behind the One campaign. We had so many brilliant, gifted people. But our problem was way too many goals. A green revolution in Africa, girls' education, energy poverty, global warming, even data poverty. We were literally all over the map. Data and One merged two very different cultures. It was tricky. We realized we were ourselves lacking in transparency. If you don't have clear sign-offs to your goals, you get overlap and dissonance. People get confused about their jobs, and we had a real schism in our organization for a time. Here's the thing. We never thought small. The stretch was always there. But our goals were so gigantic that we stretched too thin and got people worn out. OKR saved us, really. Tom Freston, chairman of One's board, saw their value. So they became part and parcel of our operation. He played a very important role. OKRs forced us to think clearly and agree on what we could achieve with the resources we had. They gave us a frame to hang our passion on. And you need that framework because without it, your brain is just too abstract. The OKR traffic lights, the color coding, they transformed our board meetings. They sharpened our strategy, our execution, our results. They made us a more effective weapon in the fight against extreme poverty. The pivot. When John Doerr arrived at our very first One board meeting, he asked a simple and profound question. Who are we working for? Who's the client here? We said, John, we're working for the world's poorest and most vulnerable. John said, well, then do they have a seat at the table? We said, of course, the whole table's there for them. But John persisted, which was important. Can you visualize that person? Shouldn't we think about them physically being at this table? That's the thinking that seeded the pivot that eventually transformed our organization one. John's prodding rhymed with a man we met in Paris once, a man from Senegal. Can't remember his name, but I remember what he said. He said, Bono, do you know the Senegalese proverb? If you want to cut a man's hair, it is better if he's in the room. He said it in a loving way, but we didn't miss the message. Be careful if you think you know what we want, because we know what we want. You're not African. And this messiah complex hasn't always turned out so well. In 2002 in Southeast Africa, I'd seen people with HIV queuing up to die. Along with many other AIDS activists, I sent up dramatic flares about the scale and devastation of this pandemic. I encouraged everyone in our organization never to say the word AIDS without adding the word emergency, the AIDS emergency. By 2009, though, there was a backlash. Some more well-heeled Africans took exception to the way we were characterizing AIDS. Though we were right, they just didn't like the way we were characterizing it. An economist named Dambisa Moyo wrote a book called Dead Aid and led the charge among those who were thinking, shove your aid, we don't need it. It's doing more damage than good. We're trying to rebrand the continent as a positive place to invest and live and work. You're hurting that. I could see that one's credibility could be under threat here. We'd focused on governments in the north because decisions made in Washington, London, and Berlin had big consequences for many of the poorest countries. Jamie and other activist friends like John Katongo, Ori Okala, Rakesh Rajani were on the ground reminding us of the same thing. Africa's future had to be decided by Africans. We had called our organization One, yet we were only half the people necessary to fix these problems. It was fantasy to think that those north of the equator could end extreme poverty without full partnership with those south of the equator. One committed to both organizational and cultural change. Even now, we're still increasing our collaborative work with African leaders, grassroots, grass tops, and all in between. We've established a growing African office in Johannesburg and around the continent. The OKRs have kept us focused on the concrete changes we need to make. Hiring staff in Africa, expanding our board, reconnecting with old Jubilee partners, and identifying new networks to turn to for advice. I guess we've become better listeners, and I don't think we could have done it without objectives and key results. Let's look at the diary. Objective. Proactively integrate a broad range of African perspectives into one's work, align more closely with African priorities, and share and leverage one's political capital to achieve specific policy changes in and toward Africa. Key results. One, 3 African-based hires complete and on board by April, and 2 African board members approved by July. 2, African Advisory Board in place by July and convened twice by December. 3, relationships fully developed with a minimum of 10 to 15 leading African thinkers who actively and regularly challenge and guide one's policy positions and external work. 4, undertake 4 participatory trips to Africa over the course of 2010. Measuring passion. Having Sudanese businessman and philanthropist Mo Ibrahim on our board is just transformative. In Africa, he is the real deal, proper rock star. He and his daughter Hadil give us the intellectual static on the continent that we really were missing and necessary, so necessary to tune into stronger channels. Mo was properly rude about some of our objectives before we met him. He steered us to Transparency is a central goal, not just in Africa, but in Europe and America. We put in the research and found that corruption drains $1 trillion a year from developing countries. This is more important than HIV/AIDS, Mo told us. This will save more lives. Corruption is killing more kids than disease, we thought to ourselves. Well, with the impetus coming from Africans, one's change has progressed. We lobbied side by side with the Publish What You Pay collective, and now it is illegal for any company on the New York Stock Exchange or in the EU to conceal what they've paid for mining rights. And last year, Aliko Dangote, whom I've heard dubbed the Bill Gates of Africa, joined our board. That's all well and good, but we've also got to be straight about the facts. For example, as of December 2017, One has 8.9 million members. 8.9 million people who've signed up online or have taken part in at least one action. Over 3 million of them now are in Africa. And I can see Bill Gates rolling his eyes and saying, big deal. Signers are not members. They're just people who sign something. He's correct, of course. But that led us to a question. How do we measure membership engagement? And whatever metric we come up with, is the number static or can it grow? We needed to prove that we could take people from signers to members to activists to catalysts. So we found ways to thank and reward our members for doing more than one action. We flooded the districts of certain US senators and congresspeople, and it became unnerving for them. For example, if you ask Kay Granger, a Republican congresswoman from Texas, she probably thinks there's people in one t-shirts everywhere pressing her to take a stand. But we're not everywhere. She was one of our strategic targets, and she really came through for One. Nobody has ever measured activist passion. Sounds odd, but it's totally okay. Or so you're passionate? How passionate? What actions does your passion lead you to do? And now when Bill Gates asks tough questions at our board meeting, we can bring out our OKRs and say, here's what we've done, and this is the impact it's had. An OKR framework. Is there a downside to OKRs? Well, if you read them incorrectly, I suppose you could get too organized. One mustn't get institutional. We need to stay disruptive. I'm always scared that we're going to go corporate and try to beat every quarterly goal. We needed John to remind us, if everything's at green, you failed. That was counterintuitive for a lot of people, especially now that we're financed up and have the best and the brightest working here. But John kept saying, more red. He was right. We needed more big ambitions, because that's what we're good at. We're less good at the incremental stuff. One isn't standing on our passion. We're not standing on our moral outrage. We're standing on a foundation built on certain principles. And with walls and floors, with a certain structure of thinking from the OKRs, and for that we are very, very grateful. It takes intellectual rigor to effect change. It requires very serious strategies indeed. If the heart doesn't find a perfect rhyme with the head, then your passion means nothing. The OKR framework cultivates the madness, the chemistry contained inside it. It gives us an environment for risk, for trust, where failing is not a fireable offense, you know, a safe place to be yourself. And when you have that sort of structure and environment, and the right people, magic is round the corner. I wasn't the best singer, even if Edge was a really talented guitar player. Adam wasn't the best bass player. And even if Larry was just getting there as a drummer. But we had our goals and a rough idea of how to reach them. We wanted to be the best band in the world.
Our final chapter, The Goals to Come. Muhammad Ali famously said, "What keeps me going is goals." Dear listener, ideas are easy. Execution is everything. You've heard how OKRs and CFRs help organizations of all stripes and sizes move mountains. You've heard firsthand accounts of how they inspire workers, develop leaders, and unify teams to do great things. By measuring what matters, objectives and key results are helping Bono and the Gates Foundation mobilize against poverty and disease in Africa. They're driving Google in its audacious 10x quest to make the world's information freely accessible to all. And they're empowering the pizza savants at Zoom to deliver robotically assembled artisanal pizzas, hot and fresh, to your door. And here's what's really exciting. I think we're just getting started. OKRs may be called a tool or a protocol or a process, but my image of choice is a launch pad. It's a point of liftoff for the next wave of entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs. My dream is to see Andy Grove's brainchild transform every walk of life. I believe it can have a huge impact on GDP growth, healthcare outcomes, school success, government performance, business results, and social progress. We're getting glimpses of that future through forward thinkers like Orly Friedman, who has introduced OKRs to every elementary school child at the Conlab School in Mountain View, California. Just imagine, you are 5 or 6 years old and setting your own goals for learning, your own objectives and key results, as you learn to reason and read. I'm convinced that if structured goal setting and continuous communication were to be widely deployed with rigor and imagination, we could see exponentially greater productivity and innovation throughout society. OKRs have such enormous potential because they are so adaptable. There is no dogma, no one right way to use them. Different organizations have fluctuating needs at various phases of their life cycle. For some, the simple act of making goals open and transparent is a big leap forward. For others, a quarterly planning cadence will change the game. It's up to you to find your points of emphasis and make the tool your own. So this book tells a handful of behind-the-scenes stories of OKRs and CFRs. But thousands more are just getting started or have yet to be told. Moving forward, we're going to continue this conversation at whatmatters.com. Please come see us there. And you can join the discussion by emailing me at john@whatmatters.com. As Dov Seidman writes in How, quote, success is something you get when you pursue something greater than yourself. My ultimate stretch OKR is to empower people to achieve the seemingly impossible together and create durable cultures for success and significance, and to prime the pump of inspiration for all the goals, especially your goals, that matter most. A dedication to Bill Campbell. This book is dedicated to two extraordinary people who left us too soon, within the span of 4 weeks in 2016. Andy Grove, the brilliant originator of the modern OKR, is remembered in some detail in these pages. Intuit's coach, Bill Campbell's wisdom, is invoked more fleetingly. Here, then, is our opportunity to celebrate Bill, a man who gave so much to so many. Bill embodied the spirit of OKRs in so many ways, from his gift for honest, open communication to his commitment to data-driven operating excellence. So it is fitting that he graces our close. It took a big tent to hold Bill's funeral mass on the Sacred Heart playing fields in Atherton, California, where he'd spent Saturdays coaching eighth-grade boys and girls in flag football or softball. The metaphor was hard to miss because Bill's life was a tent of unmatched proportions. More than 3,000 mourners attended, from Larry Page and Jeff Bezos to generations of the once young people who played for him. He'd embraced every one of us with his unabashed bear hugs and selfless guidance. And every one of us believed that Bill was our best friend, The son of a gym teacher who worked nights at the steel mill in Homestead, Pennsylvania, Bill first earned his sobriquet by coaching